Welcome, everybody. So glad you made it. I've been charged with moderating this panel. I was going to say an impossible challenge, but hopefully we can make it. We're going to make it possible. So the challenge is to discuss the roadmap or how we can address the quantum, the cosmological aspects of quantum gravity. So we have five great panelists. I'm going to introduce them in a minute. By the way, I'm Nia Shefshurdi. I'm an associate faculty here, in case you don't know me. I charge our panelists with three questions, but one of them, Robert Brandenberger, he actually suggested a fourth question. So I put it as number zero, which is the context of this discussion.
Did bias to 3+1 space-time, or?
Well, yeah, exactly. So we don't care about higher dimensions for this panel. I think it's well, except well, hopefully no one will be offended. So we have the number zero, which is the context for this discussion. What are the outstanding challenges which quantum approaches in cosmology are facing? That's of course a very important question. But what I like to do, we would like to strive to do, is to create a roadmap to make progress in addressing these challenges. So of course, it's important to know what the challenges are, but then we want to go further and identify, with the help of the audience here, where we see progress as most likely and or imminent, and I've highlighted the words that I think are most important I'd like to focus on, as most likely or imminent in understanding the quantum aspects of cosmology, where we should focus our resources. And in fact, that's the second question in developing a successful strategy, because we always have finite resources. So how should we focus our intellectual, experimental, or observational resources to address our puzzles in quantum cosmology? We should realize that these are all complementary resources, and there's a finite amount of them. So if we want to make concrete progress, we have to try to agree and spend them wisely and identify the directions where we think progress is more likely. And finally, we have people of very different backgrounds in this room, ethnicity, intellectual, and ideas wise. So where can we see as promising areas of collaboration? So this is the charge for the panel. So I also requested our panelists to each give a 5-minute introduction, and if they send me some slides if they want, they all have been kind enough to do that and accept the 5-minute request. We'll see how well that 5 minutes is gonna go. So they all kindly enough sent me their slides. So I'm just gonna go through them alphabetically, and I do have a pointer, and if you want, you could use this, or I can advance them myself. Okay, so our first panelist is Abhay Ashtekar from Institute for Gravitation and the Cosmos and Physics Department at Penn State. He, of course, gave the first talk of the session this morning. You should assume that he's also building up on what he talked about this morning. Here, our first panelist as introduction is Abhay. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so since we are only 5 minutes, I thought that rather than really addressing these questions, I would just give an example in the way that these questions could be addressed. But before I begin that, I just want to say that what we're seeing, both in CMB, but with really a spectacular way, more spectacular way, with gravitational waves, is that the influx of observations has really had deep, deep impact on the whole theoretical activity. And I think in the forthcoming years, I think the same thing will happen. In particular, for example, the B polarization measurements will be made. There are several missions. There's also, for me personally, I'm very interested in the measurements of the optical depth, tau, for reasons I mentioned in my talk. Namely, it's the least well-measured parameter in CMB by Planck. This error is about 13.6%, and it could be reduced to 1%. And that, for example, would be enough to distinguish the values of tau that, for example, the one of the LQC models predicts and what Planck predicts. And then there's, of course, the standard, the problem that is around for quite some time, which is the Hubble tension. And that is something that I think, in my view, it will really affect our understanding of a later time universe rather than very, very early universe. But I think what I really want to sort of give you this example is really the following. And this example is really motivated by the remarks that were made in the first 2 days of the conference repeatedly, that quantum gravity, experiment is way out of the reach, and we'll never, we should just ignore that part, and we'll look at theoretical consistencies and constraints and so on and so forth. And I think that is not the case. I think the experiments are really within reach. And this is a very nice example, very, very concrete example in which we see that. So basically, I just want to recall for everybody that we have the notion of power spectrum. It is really extracted out of the two-point correlations for CMB, the scalar modes, which are quantum fields. And then we also have the bispectrum, which is a three-point function, correlation function. And that is really completely determined, as you see on the slide there, by products of the two-point functions. And then there is also, or the power spectrum, if you like, that is the products of the power spectrum of two-point functions, the PR of K1, PR of K2. And then there's a multiple, and that multiple is the FNL. And if the state was purely Gaussian, then this we would not have this FNLs would be zero. But because the odd moments all vanished, and here this is a three-point function. So the question is about measuring these FNLs. Now, there are many models which have bouncing cosmologies. Loop quantum cosmology is a concrete example, but there are many other models up here. And in many of these models, the bounces occur in the pre-inflationary evolution, that is to say between the bounce and the what I call the onset of inflation, the time at which the largest observable mode exists, the Hubble horizon, that's what I call onset. And the dynamics between the bounce and this is different in these different models, and that evolution can lead to large FNLs. But typically what happens is that these large FNLs are there only for unobservable modes, super horizon modes, whose wavelength is very, very large, and they're exponentially suppressed for the observable mode. But given the prediction of the model, this is a key point, it is suppressed. But the question is, can we still see it in the power spectra by looking at analyzing the power spectrum in different ways? Now, the point is that even if the signal is very small, we'll learn from LIGO-Virgo collaborations, for example, that it can be extracted out if you had theoretical templates which tell you what the signal should look like. So if you have a theoretical template, then that particular signal could be actually extracted out even if the noise is very large. So this is the idea that was used very nicely earlier this year by Van Tent, Salgado, and Durer. And what they did was the following. They made an ansatz for these FNLs, which is n is some number, which is unspecified, and then an exponential dependence. And that exponential dependence is a free parameter alpha up there. And that parameter really depends on the pre-inflationary evolution in these bouncing models up here. So it's a number. Which varies from model to model. And then you've got factors, which are really this K1 plus K2 plus K3, divided by each of these models comes with a K, the co-moving wave number, at the bounce. And so we just look at that. That's the answers they made. And then they looked at the signals, CMB data, and they sort of, using matched filtering, if you like, with respect to this, they tried to find out if, in fact, this FNL is compatible, and they put a bound that, and said that n, which is bigger than or equal to 10 to the 3, which occurs in certain models, they're ruled out by the Planck data. And therefore, the observations actually constrain this pre-inflationary evolution from the bounds to the onset of inflation. And this really is happening in many of these models in the quantum gravity era. So this really is probing the quantum gravity era, and that is very, 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 very good. But there's a limitation or a caveat, namely that in these various models, the absolute value of FNL is, in fact, of that particular type. But the authors miss the fact that many of these models also have rapid oscillations. In other words, you have got that multiplied by some, trigonometric function, which oscillates into positive and negative parts very, very rapidly. And then when we actually look at the sky, we don't directly observe the bispectrum, which is K1, K2, K3, but rather what we observe is really where to make a transform to the physical space using basically the Bessel functions and integrating K1, K2, K3, or D3, K1, D3, K2, D3, K2. And that projection actually basically is like taking a little window and averaging the effect on that window. And therefore, because of these oscillations, the effect is in the models where there are oscillations, the effect is much, much smaller than what the analysis actually thought it was. And in fact, for example, in the LQC, a paper came out in August that showed that, in fact, these oscillations are such that there is no problem at all with respect to observations. Now, the point about this example, to me, it's a very beautiful example in which, first of all, it's a very concrete way of actually digging out, by clever methods, effects from the existing data to test quantum gravity regime. And secondly, it also brings out the subtleties. That is to say, it's not some gross taste, but really subtle things like the oscillations matter. And so, therefore, I feel that this is a very interesting, this is a prototype of things that we could do, clever things that we could do to probe the quantum gravity regime. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Abel. And you almost swearing within time, within like order of magnitude. That's good. can I use the pointer?
Oh,
I think yes. Perfect. Thanks. Very good. And we're going to just remember your comments or questions and points of discussion. We're going to come back to them in a minute or in a few minutes. So our next panelist is Professor Robert Bonenberger from McGill University. And he is going to tell us about puzzles in, well, I'm going to just let him lead the way. Yes, you can use this. Yeah, there you go. Just this one goes forward. And then this is a pointer.
So first of all, thanks to the organizers for inviting me to be on this panel. I would like to dedicate these short remarks, to Lee Smolin. Ever since I've known Lee, Lee has emphasized that what one should do is one should challenge established ideas and try to look for new radical approaches. Now, I think we have outstanding challenges to quantum approaches to cosmology. And I'd like to mention two of them in this slide. Now, I think all of you know about the dark energy mystery. But what I want to emphasize is what I view as a unitarity crisis of the current paradigm of early universe cosmology. And this includes what we heard about this morning. So, the current paradigm of early universe cosmology is something that involves a period of inflation treated as an effect of field theory. And here you see a space-time diagram. Time is the vertical axis, space is the horizontal axis. The period of inflation is this period between Ti and T sub r. Now, in such models, what happens is that transplanckian modes, they exit the Hubble radius and they enter the classical region. So modes which are excluded, which do not exist in the effective field theory, they suddenly should become classical. So now for those of you who don't like the word unitarity, from the point of view of classical physics, this is predictability. So I would maintain that our current paradigm of early universe cosmology is non-unitary and it has loss of predictability. Okay, so you can parameterize the constraint on unitary and predictable models in terms of this trans-Planckian censorship conjecture, which says that simply no modes that had a wavelength which was smaller than the Planck length at some early times, the wavelength never became larger than the Hubble scale. Now, there are three justifications that I can give for this trans-Planckian censorship conjecture by Bedroya and Waffer, and none of them involve string theory. So one of them is simply Penrose's black hole censorship conjecture. It is translated from black hole physics to cosmology. The second is unitarity, which I illustrated on the previous graph. And the third is the second law of thermodynamics. I would maintain that the current models of inflation, they violate the second law of thermodynamics in the sense that the entanglement entropy, which builds up by the end of inflation, is larger than the entropy that we want at the beginning of the Big Bang phase. So based on this, I would maintain that standard cosmological inflation is ruled out, and we need something new. So this is a major challenge. Now, to make a connection with dark energy, this same argument means that dark energy cannot be a bare cosmological constant, because then the unitarity problem would hit us in the future. In fact, even the quintessence models of dark energy are constrained. So bottom line is that we need something really different. To make another connection with dark energy, effective field theory in a conservative way leads to the quantum aspect of the cosmological constant problem. If there's something better, then the quantum aspect of the cosmological constant problem might not exist. Okay, so these are the challenges and lessons. In order to describe both early and late time cosmology, I think we need to go beyond effective field theory. Now, lessons from particle physics, if we want to go from classical particle physics to something which, at least without gravity, is consistent, we have to replace particles by something completely different. So I'd like to put forward the idea that in order to really get something that describes gravity and matter at a quantum level, we need something that contains neither matter nor neither the metric nor the matter fields as fundamental objects. Now, if I didn't have a model to demonstrate this, I wouldn't be sitting here. So last slide is actually an idea of how to proceed. So let's take a quantum mechanical matrix model, the so-called BFSS matrix model. There's no space. There are 10 Hermitian n by n matrices. In the limit n going to infinity, you get a non-perturbative definition of superstring theory. You take this model at finite temperature. Now there's no more evolution. Everything has to emerge from that. And if you take the Matsubara zero modes to get an emergent space-time, it turns out that there's a natural definition of length. There's a natural definition of co-moving coordinates. Therefore, there's an emergent metric. And it turns out that in the n equals going to infinity limit, the metric is spatially flat. You get an emergent infinite-dimensional space. Time runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. The metric is emergent. The metric emergence are spatially flat. The non-zero Matsubara modes, they give us thermal fluctuations. There's no cosmological constant because we are never quantizing a harmonic oscillator. Obviously, this might be completely wrong, but this is at least an approach to look for something completely new. And this would give rise to a space-time picture, which is an emergent cosmology like that which was proposed by Waffer and myself in prehistoric times before the invention of the archive. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Robert. Very good. I think the next... Again, remember your questions and comments. The next is Ghazal. So Ghazal Geçtinizcani is a faculty here at Parameter Institute. And take it away, Ghazal.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Glad to be here on this panel. And I want to thank the organizer, especially I know Alicia and postdocs have put so much effort in putting together all of you here. So let me... I'm going to build up on what Robert was just saying, except that I'm a child of revolutions. I hate radicalist ideas, so I like stability and, non-crisis idea. I love our cosmology story to be a nice bedtime story, but only if life worked that way. So there are, then I'm gonna go over the things that while I'm telling my son that story at bedtime, there are things that bug my brain and like I don't quite know how to deal with them. And I don't think this is news to many of you here. Things that in cosmology we haven't quite answered and we are still puzzled with. The dark matter, which I'm not getting into it much. The dark energy that Robert brought up, and obviously the early universe, things that I think may be the most relevant to quantum gravity and the quantum nature of the physics. Right, so like early time, inflation, bounce, other phases, all of this thing, if you want to build it up, how we go through that. Do we have a Big Bang singularity? Do we not have a Big Bang singularity? I mean, most of our cosmological stories like pretty much patch together nicely, except when we get to this this part of this story. One thing that always amazes me and sounds like magic, and we do it like bread and butter in cosmology, whether you do inflation, whether you bounce, most of this relies on quantum field theory in care of the space-time. And we use it to in order to produce the initial condition for larger scale structure. And the observations we have, cosmic microwave background and so on. And then the late time, right? The CC problem, the old one. As Robert pointed out, we really haven't answered that, right? And there is this misconception in my colleagues in astrophysics. They think, oh, just take it to be a constant and that solves the problem. And it doesn't work that way, right? You cannot just allow it to be one constant that easily if you're working with EFT, effective field theory, and maybe Yasaman will build on that. It cannot be just a constant if you have all these things that throughout the history of the universe, you get more vacuum contribution to that. How do we keep it the same constant that it was billions of years ago? So the early times, right? The list is here. And going back to this magic, I think, and I know Robert might disagree with us a lot, like the fact that we'd use in inflation or in bouncing scenarios in other, we predict this picture is produced by quantum field theory and vacuum fluctuations in expanding background or contracting background. That's kind of, we are claiming, we have something like, we are testing Hawking radiation, Onroo effect, right? We are having particle productions, and because of the expanding nature of the background, we have done it and we are observing it. I think that's a big claim, and it always remains as a question to me, are we really doing that? Because I know you have mentioned it, like this spectrum, this power spectrum came up before we were using these tools. Sonia von Zeldovich pointed it out that it would look like this. The inflation itself, even if I take it at its face values, I cannot just peacefully sleep at night because I know by itself it has unanswered puzzles. No matter, and this is a little bit of shameful promotion for our recent work with Jerome Quenting and Eric Ling, which we do the extensive look into different possibilities for initial condition for initial background of the inflationary scenarios. And you see, no matter which route you take, you end up with some kind of trouble. In particular, when you look at it, like it looks like the only ones that the background could be extendable and you don't have geodesic incompleteness, you would have to reach this background very closely to the extent that, again, cosmological constant appears like an initial condition. And as we know, that's a crisis by itself, and I think goes back to this point that we have here. I think I basically want to end here with all these puzzles that are still, I would like in all of them maybe tell myself, well, quantum gravity, I'm gonna solve it, but how and in which way, I don't know.
Okay, thank you. I think actually Mary's next. Thanks, perfect timing, Ghazal. There you go. Thank you. So I guess you can go to the next slide. I can into. So Mary Sacalariado is a professor at King's College, London. Take it away, Mary.
Okay, let me start by thanking the organizers for putting together this interesting meeting and the invitation for this panel. Being fourth in a panel in cosmology, for sure you're going to repeat what some other people said before, but probably I will be a bit cautious about certain things. So let me start by saying that there are really very strong affinities between cosmology and quantum gravity. So that's something that we have to keep in mind. We need quantum gravity in cosmology. Quantum gravity needs cosmology in order to test their predictions. So that's the first point. So let me then give the fundamental questions that we have in cosmology in two sets. So I have the primary ones and let's say the secondary. The origin of an early time of exponential expansion, do we accept the by hand putting a scalar field with an inflaton potential, or we take some kind of alternatives? After ages of work in inflation, after thousands of papers, it remains a paradigm instead of a theory. The origin of the late-time accelerated expansion, what it was even said before by Robert et al. About the issue of dark energy. The origin of cosmological perturbations, are they the kind of quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field we put by hand? Are given by a bouncing model? Are quantum fluctuations of your geometry coming from a quantum gravity proposal? And then, of course, the open question, what is dark matter? There are experiments for years and years. The question remains open. And then the second, with a less priority, is the emergence of space and time in the standard cosmology, as we know, comes from singularity. And, of course, to explain the space-time dimensionality. So, So there are two types of approaches that people follow, the bottom-up or the top-down. The bottom-up is what I call the one driven by the data. So you have the data and you try to explain and you come up with an ad hoc model. And these kind of bottom-up models, they are not embedded in any fundamental theory. As an example, all the F of R models which exist in the literature, people have been working in order, for instance, to explain the dark energy. Or we take the top-down models, which are what I call the fundamental models. For example, flux compactification models of inflation in the context of string cosmology, bouncy cosmological scenario in LQC, early time exponential expansion in the context of group field cosmology. And of course, I'm going to follow the second approach. That's my personal kind of, from what I told you before, is an ad hoc, I'm not going to buy it, so I much more prefer the top-down models. But here, we have to be very cautious. In other words, we should not put the curvature by hand, we should not put the matter Hamiltonian by hand. Why I'm saying that? Because there are many studies, or quite some studies in the literature, where you take the matter Hamiltonian by hand, you have your kind of quantum gravity motivated cosmological scenario, and then you take a field which you call inflaton, and you try to see how the dynamics of this field is going to be changed because you have a Friedman equation with extra terms. And I don't think that this gives too much kind of insight. It's an exercise that you can do. You can give it to your students to do it, but doesn't help in order to address, for instance, the problem of the onset of the early time of exponential expansion, which should come from the gravitational sector of your theory, so from a quantum gravity kind of approach. And cosmology is indeed the ideal, I believe, test of quantum gravity. By that, I mean the quantum theory of space-time geometry, and the tool that has been used very much lately is through gravitational waves. Gravitational waves can be used in order not only to test GR, but also beyond GR or quantum gravity kind of approaches, and the differences are going to show in the generation of gravitational waves, and this you can study by studying a waveform analysis, propagation via either a modified dispersion relation by refringence or amplitude damping, polarizations, you are going to have extra polarization modes, and finally, by studying what will be the remnant properties. And just to give you an example here, by just one kind of the binary neutral star, the GW170817, the Valli, Copadacci, Porati models of dark energy with small transition steepness have been ruled out. group field theory, spin forms, or loop quantum cosmology, we have shown that they could generate a signal which could be detectable with standard sirens. And if you do not have electromagnetic counterpart, there are many models motivated from quantum gravity where you are going to have that the speed of propagation of gravitational waves is different than the speed of light. It depends on the frequency, and then we have shown how LISA may be able to put constraints there. So there are indeed strong affinities between cosmology and quantum gravity, but one should be very careful. In other words, the theory of quantum gravity that we adopt, it should not just be consistent with itself, but it should explain the universe in which we live, which means space-time is Lorentzian and not Euclidean. Space-time is not anti-De Sitter, so we do not have negative cosmological constant. Space-time dimensionality is equal to 4. And the last kind of cautious that I would like to put here, data that we get from any observational kind of probe we have, raw data, are useless. In order to be able to study them, you have to put them in a particular framework. Let me give you an example. Lambda CDM is a phenomenological model which has not been proven correct. It has been proven consistent with itself. You have your data, you put the model, you find the model, you fix the parameters. And therefore, I'm very cautious when we take data which have been analyzed within the framework of a Lambda CDM model that try to show some kind of discrepancies with existing the model by just putting there by hand corrections coming from a quantum gravity kind of proposals. So physics, physical laws depend on different scales, and if we apply these laws in all scales, probably discrepancies happen, and probably the H not kind of tension could have an origin there. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So I was going to draw something at quantum gravity and cosmology are good friends, but I wasn't quite figure out what's the right graphic for it, so we'll come back to that. So the last but not least is Dr. Yasaman Yazdi, who is at Institute for Advanced Study in Dublin. And take it away, Yasaman.
Thank you, Niyesh. So when Niyesh gave us the task to think about and comment on these three questions on the board, most of the thoughts that came to my mind that I wanted to share were quite broad in nature and not necessarily with some specific quantum cosmology question in mind or specific approach or model in mind. So that's going to be the nature of a lot of the comments that I'm going to make on these questions. Having said that, I am inevitably influenced a bit by my research in causal set theory and more recently in cosmology. At the same time, I think I'm also influenced a bit by having been for a while what feels like a spectator of research in cosmology, and only more recently more involved in doing that research on the intersection of cosmology and quantum gravity. So that's sort of going to be the context of the broad comments that I'm going to make. And I'll go through each of the three questions that Niyesh posed to us, and I'll give sort of my answers to them. So the first question was, where do you see progress as most likely and or imminent in understanding the quantum aspects of cosmology and why? So I've highlighted the word progress, and I'm happy to see that Niyesh also highlighted the word progress, maybe coincidentally. And the reason I've highlighted this word is that I think there are different things we can consider as progress. And depending on which of those things we prioritize, the answer we would give to this question would be different. So I've listed here some examples of what we might consider as progress. So one of them is to find a new model that fits all current high-precision cosmological data. And this would bring with it a resolution of some of the current cosmological tensions that we have, which have emerged as a result of our observations becoming more and more precise over time, but our standard model of cosmology, lambda CDM, not keeping up with those observations, and some cracks starting to show. Another shape that progress might look like is to come up with new predictions or new signatures or effects that we can go look for either in current or future experiments or observations. And yet another interpretation of progress would be to find a narrative for what we see in the universe that is well motivated and plausible. And I think it's fair to say we don't have that right now. And this is obviously not an exhaustive list, and these points aren't mutually exclusive. And since we're talking about quantum aspects of cosmology, all of these points would, in one way or another, either use, relate to, or be inspired by quantum gravity or semi-classical gravity. So that's what we have in mind. And my personal favorite out of these is the last one. So finding a narrative for what we see in the universe that is well motivated and plausible. So I'm going to answer this question focusing on this form of progress, and also the other two questions having this form of progress as the focus. So with this in mind, I think a fruitful thing to do is to think about open questions in quantum cosmology in the context of different existing frameworks of quantum gravity. We are already doing this to some extent. We should continue doing this, and we should do more of it. So quantum gravity approaches already come with a lot of physical motivation. So in doing this, we sort of have a head start on this goal of looking for that narrative that is well-motivated and plausible. And also, quantum gravity approaches are a rich enough arena to hope to tackle several different open questions in cosmology at once, and that would help with the plausibility of the picture that we end up with. And maybe a more specific point in line with this goal is that, so maybe we can put a bit more weight on the motivations behind ideas and focus a bit less, at least initially, when we build new models on things like the number of parameters in these models and some more quantitative metrics of how well we are fitting the data, things like the chi-square, because at least it feels like our understanding or our connection to fundamental physics is lagging a lot behind the large amount of data that we have, and demanding too much at once could be compromising some of our understanding of that data. So regarding the question of how should we focus our intellectual and or experimental / observational resources to address our puzzles in quantum cosmology, I have two comments on that. I think that an effective strategy is to alternate back and forth between theoretical model development and comparisons with observations. So we should neither focus too much on theoretical development too far down the line before we look at observational data, and we should also not look so closely at all of the observational data that we have and engineer a model to fit that. It should be some balance between these two. We should start with an initial theoretical model with good motivations, and when it's ready, we should go look at observations, look at what works, what doesn't work, its strengths and weaknesses, and then go back to our theoretical framework and see if we can address some of those weaknesses still within the framework of our theory and still in a well-motivated way, and then repeat this, keep going back and forth between observation and theory. And for this to work well, theorists and observational cosmologists need to talk to each other more. So these two communities think very differently. And for example, a point which was also raised by Mary and who has raised this in the past as well, which is an important one, is that often raw data gets processed with a theory in mind. And that is not necessarily transparent in the processing of that data. But if the observational cosmologists are aware of the different kinds of theories and models that we are considering, it would help them be more transparent about that, and it would help them understand why other things are possible as well. And on the other side of things, theorists should be willing to get their hands dirty and do the data analysis for their models. So finally, where do you see as promising areas of collaboration or synergy among different approaches? So I think that the value of coming together collectively will not necessarily be in the form of a collaboration or using necessarily techniques from one approach in another, but rather, and why meetings like this are so important and useful, I think that we really need to talk to each other and run by each other our ideas and models, because it's not my universe or your universe, it's a single universe. And if we're going to have any hope at arriving at this narrative that is going to be well-motivated and plausible, we're going to have to some extent agree across different approaches on that narrative. Now, of course, well-motivated and plausible are subjective things, so maybe not everyone will agree, but it's fair to expect a good number of people across different approaches to come to some agreement and to have those conversations effectively. We need to be critical and open to ideas from other approaches and give good criticism, but also give positive and constructive feedback when you see it in other approaches. And I'm happy to be sitting among people that I know have a habit of doing this. So that's all. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's thank all the panelists. Perfect. So this should start working now. I can take that. I think we've gone through the slides, and I tried to kind of summarize the main points as I saw it. There could be something that I missed, so you can. I'm starting to run out of room, but I can see there are some empty spaces on the board, so we can still keep writing things down. So I want to open the floor for discussion, or the people online or here, if there are additional points that someone wants to make. I know there are others in the audience who have very strong opinions. I'm looking at you, Neil. Yeah. So so please let me know. Okay, I see Neil raised his hand. There you go.
I just wanted to compliment all the speakers on the tone of the discussion, which I thought was excellent. Let me say something critical.
I know I put you on the spot, there are others as well. Yeah, go.
Yes. So let me direct my comment to Abai. It seems to me that you have, I hope I'm wrong, but you've given up on the hope of predicting what we see in terms of the large-scale perturbations. I mean, that I find that puzzling because you're working on what purports to be a fundamental approach. But then when we look at the observations, all these numbers you're not predicting except for the optical depth, which is the very last one I would worry about predicting. The optical depth is entirely due to astrophysical effects, we believe. And so, you know, for me, what will make a theory convincing is if it predicts the amplitude of the perturbations, the spectral tilt, you know, ultimately the abundance of dark matter, the cosmological constant. I don't think we should give up on that.
I'm sorry, I could only hear part of your thing.
I can summarize what Nadneel said, that he wants you to predict the amplitude of fluctuations, the tilt, and the cosmological constant. And that's the only way you can convince it.
No, not you, all of
them.
Yeah, so I mean, the point is that what one is doing here is, okay. There are several issues about predict here. I mean, because in everything there is some input, right? I mean, for example, gravitational waves are so spectacular, and Mary was saying that that in standard cosmology, what we have is consistency rather than it is actually proved. But the same thing is true with gravitational waves, because we assume general relativity to create the waveforms, and we do that. That I think everybody would agree, substantial progress. So I think what we do is also take the data that is available, and now from the theory, one would like to have, you know, much more first principle derivations or something. And I mean, what one can hope to do is to go beyond what we know right now. So for example, it would be much better not to use any inflationary potential, but really get it from first principles. And now, in loop quantum cosmology, there is an ongoing program, basically because, as I was explaining this morning, at a fundamental level, there is a fundamental non-locality, and therefore, you know, you will get corrections to Einstein's theory, and, I mean, Eugenio Bianchi, particularly in his group, are following this idea that that would actually lead to Starobinsky inflation. It's not finished, and there's problems which I can discuss. So you know, we're definitely doing that. In terms of actually optical depth and so on. Yeah. So what we have is the data, and in order to propagate the primordial spectrum to what we actually see, we need to have these parameters, and this is just a standard, you know, of course. Standard code, the Boltzmann code, that will run and give us this. So, I mean, it's one of the parameters, and then the test of a model is really that we have a primordial spectrum, and then you evolve it using this Boltzmann code, and then make predictions as to what we see, and then compare it with the experiment, and we try to minimize chi-squared. Now, for L less than 30, the chi-squared that is coming from loop quantum cosmology is about 4.5% less than standard inflation, standard answers. So therefore, one can take those parameters as being more, you know, more reliable in that sense up here. And then they agree with the five of the parameters are the same, but optical depth is much different. And therefore, if there were actually an independent, I mean, at the moment, and it's also the worst measured parameter. So, and people have these independent missions to measure this optical depth completely differently. So if it came out, you know, closer to what LQC predicts, which is higher than the standard answer, then it's a feather in the cap. It doesn't prove it. We don't prove things. We can only disprove things. We cannot prove things. I mean, that's a fundamental thing that we learned already from Einstein and Planck, right?
Yeah, it just seems to me the more promising approach to tau would be to find independent observations at late time in the universe, which literally measure the ionization history.
Exactly. That's what will be.
People will never be convinced by a fit to some primordial spectrum, which involves tau. You need to actually measure tau which is feasible.
No, that's exactly the point. The measurements of optical depth are very good. That's exactly my point. Thank you for making it.
So I want to...
Before you do that, I think you should change that word to post-it. And I think that addresses some of this.
Okay, so I'm going to do that. But Mary had a point to make, and Lee then afterwards. But okay.
Yeah, I would like to say something to your comment about the gravitational waves. I mean, what I said before is, for just to give you an example, you can take the modified dispersion relation, which of course is not what exists in GR, and then you can put constraints in the new parameters, which actually can map back to whatever other theory that you have beyond GR. In the same thing, as we said before, if I take the CMB data and I analyze them with a model which is beyond lambda CDM, then I can put constraints, exactly what you said before. It's the same thing like testing the CMB data with isocurvature or adiabatic perturbation. So you have to change the conditions you have and then you can test. But if they have been analyzed within lambda CDM, you find the discrepancy and then you go posteriori to somehow tune it through some corrections that you put now, there is where I have the problem. That's why this kind of interplay and discussion between the people who have the data and analyze them the way they know and what is the kind of, you know, the more vanilla kind of approach, or if you have some corrections, that's where the discussion should take place. The same is for birefringent, the same is for luminosity distance and all that, but you have to give a framework so the people who have the data can analyze within the new framework. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mary. Perfect. So Lee had a question. Go ahead, Lee.
Yes. Is the quantum theory of cosmology a quantum theory? If it is, then, like all other quantum theories, it must predict some things while leaving other things undetermined. And so there, if it is a quantum theory, which we could just argue, but nobody's argued here that it's not, then there, we should be able to identify physical cosmological pairs which are mutually indeterminable.
Sorry, are you saying you want to have the pairs of cosmological observables that don't have an Heisenberg-Arsenio principle? Is that what?
Yes, I think if we find the quantum theory of cosmology, and it's a conventional quantum theory, then there will be, like in all quantum theories, there will be pairs of mutually incompatible data.
Yeah.
And therefore, we won't be able to predict everything.
I think that sounds like an interesting proposal. I don't think that's the only way to have quantum cosmology, but that would be very in-your-face way of having quantum cosmology. That would be great. So I had Francesca on this side. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. I have a reaction about... Neil, you were using the word giving up on trying to predict things. The problem is that in quantum gravity, there are people coming from different communities. And depending on the community you come from, some things may come as a prediction, and some other things may just come as an input in the theory. So, for instance, if you think about quantum gravity as a unification theory and you want to have new particles, new fields, and so on, of course, you want maybe your quantum gravity theory to try to predict the dark matter and dark energy. But if you come from a quantum gravity community, that just wants to quantize gravity and don't think that there is a unification there, maybe to be pursued so strongly, then maybe the cosmological constant is just a parameter of your theory that you insert. And who knows, maybe dark matter could be something we already know, not necessarily a particle. So as all the indications that we had so far seems to go in this direction. So I would be careful about putting a charge about giving up or not giving up. Maybe we have these things already there. It's just a different perspective.
So Neil, go ahead.
A quick comment on Lee. I think it's more general than quantum dualities. So, for example, when you think about the thermodynamics of cosmologies, why is lambda what it is? Why is Hubble constant what it is? What's the history of a typical cosmology? As soon as you discuss thermodynamics, you have to usually have to fix something in order to predict something else. So if we have a box full of gas, we need to know how much energy, how many particles, or the pressure. You know, there are conjugate variables in the thermodynamic sense as well. And it's quite possible that in the universe, these conjugate variables, you know, you have to fix some of them in order to predict the others. So it goes beyond quantum.
Okay, so Lee, maybe you respond, and then I have Susan here. Did you want to say something, Lee?
Just very quickly, this is why I talk these days about trialities of variables and not dualities. Okay. I'd be happy to explain that.
Okay, thank you. So I just wanted to make a comment on what Francesca was saying, that there are these constants that we have measured very well. You might be able to explain them somehow. They're not exactly, as Ghazal mentioned, they're not predictions, but if you could give a very precise value for them, which is later confirmed, that's a plus for you. Of course, what I really like that I think Yasemin mentioned was the prospect for new predictions, that it's that would be a really kind of big bonus if you could come up predict something that people haven't thought about, not just another digit on lambda, or just a different way of different anthropic principle or non-anthropic way of saying what lambda is, but something that we haven't thought about, but somehow comes out of your theory, and then experimentals go out and test them. That's a real way to make progress. Well, I mean, I'm saying that's not the only way, but that would be wonderful if that happens.
Can I follow up on your comment?
Okay, so I have, let's see. I had Robert's hand first, and then Abai. Robert?
Okay, so can you hear me? Yeah, yes. So in my presentation, I only addressed the first point. I would like to just throw out some suggestions. So given the fact that we now have measured gravitational waves, and the fact that there are missions to measure the polarization of a microwave background, I would think combining the efforts in those two communities would be very useful. In fact, one of the goals should be to try to get the tilt of the gravitational wave spectrum. I would say that's a goal that should be, it's not something that can be achieved in 5 years, but maybe in a 10-year time frame. The tilt of the gravitational wave spectrum would allow us to falsify classes of cosmological models. It would teach us a lot. So in terms of answering question number two, this is what I would actually put forward. But I'm a pencil and paper theorist, so my words shouldn't count very much on that.
We can't stop there. We can even calculate on Gaussianity for gravitational waves at some point.
Yep, there is FNL and whatever it is for gravitational waves. I'm not sure. Okay, so Abe, go ahead.
I just wanted to go back to Francesca and your comment on that. I mean, of course, I completely agree that if there is any fundamental explanation for the value of the cosmological constant, that would be great. But it's equally true that it'll be great if there is a fundamental explanation for the value of Newton's constant. And we are not worked up about it. I mean, we all agree with that. But we're not all worked up about it, right? We're not saying losing our sleep. And this was not always the case. Because when I was a graduate student, I mean, various people were saying this again and again. Why is a gravitational constant so small? Because if I compared it with electromagnetic constant, I mean, Feynman has said this, and it's about 10 to the minus 39, 10 to the minus 40. Why is it so small? It's a big puzzle. And the point is that we're not lost sleep on it. We said, yes, if somebody explains it, it's great. But in the meanwhile, we don't want to say that, oh, there's a big problem, and unless I solve it, I'm stuck with gravity. And so I feel exactly the same thing is true with the cosmological constant, you know. I think we should, as Francesca was saying, we should go on. Of course, we should keep in mind, if anybody comes with a great idea, yes, great, fantastic.
I could be wrong, but my impression is not that issue is not that it's just a small. That is a problem. We'd like to, but I mean, Cliff is not here, but comment I often need in EFT, it's not also protected. Like if you have phase transition and you have vacuum contribution, how do you keep it at that value?
Right. So in this case, I mean, unfortunately, I wanted to comment on that, but unfortunately, I'm not up on the literature, so that's why I can't. Yeah. But there was very, very, very good work by rigorous quantum field theory people like Stefan Hollands on this case. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they did this work in the context of quantum field theory with operator product expansions very systematically in Tacitus space-time and try to look at exactly the kind of field theoretical questions when people are. And their strong claim is that, in fact, all these problems come because one puts a cutoff. And if one puts a cutoff, then, of course, you know, you're violating all kinds of things, and then these problems come up. But if you did it rigorously, then for non-interacting fields, that they had a paper on that, and they also did interacting fields, but I'm not up with that. They showed that, in fact, the problem is opposite. If you do it carefully, then, in fact, the cosmological constant comes out to be, or the vacuum expectation value comes out to be smaller than the observed one, not larger than the observed one. So I mean, it's not a problem because
sorry,
it's fine.
Whose work is that?
This is Stefan Hollands and
they got it from a standard model, they get a smaller value than, or from what sort of theory?
They were doing quantum field theory in curved space-time, operator-varied expansions, and they're just looking at, you know, the work that was done was for free fields in curved space-time.
Right, right. But, okay.
But then there is further work also on interacting fields. But, you know, this is not done. So
I think I have to move this discussion. I know Suzanne had a point, but on a different topic. So I said, Alicia, you go ahead. You go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Yes, so I want to comment about cosmological constant, following up on what Francesca said. I can very much agree on her point. So it is clear that with our theories, we want to make predictions, so we need to predict a set of observables, but there will be also free parameters. We cannot predict everything, and perhaps the input can vary from theory to theory. And taking the case of the cosmological constant, for instance, in the case of unimodular gravity, that is just a parameter that enters the theory. You don't need to compute it. And also in the context of quantum field theory, I have a quantum field theory background, there is a very specific reason why we might not need to compute lambda, and that is because lambda is a relevant parameter, like G Newton. In a sense, it is a similar question as asking like why the electron mass is like that. I mean, it is like that. We don't need to explain every single number in our theories, as long as they make predictions based on a few inputs, a few free parameters.
I just want to follow up on that, is that it's okay that you cannot predict anything, but it's good to predict something. And I think that's the point, is that the progress is made through the newer steps. And if you predict something that can be tested, that could be progress, and I like it would be good to recognize that and, of course, make progress. Go ahead.
Yes, so I have a question that is related to the comment that Mairi was making.
Sorry, we cannot hear you.
Sorry. Better now?
Yes.
Okay, so I have a question related to the comment that Mairi was making about coupling of matter to gravity. So it seems that you were suggesting that one should not just choose some matter content and couple it to gravity, like, for example, as a stand for early universe cosmology with the inflaton field. So my question for you would be, so what approach would you use? Like, what would be your approach to early universe cosmology? And then also to the other panelists, do you think that the inflaton field is kind of the end of the story, or is there other meta contents that you consider important?
Yeah, I mean, yes, for me it's important that the matter part of the theory emerges from the quantum gravity theory itself. So that is my, let's say, the kind of concern that I have when the matter Hamiltonian is put by hand. The only kind of suggestion which I know and I have worked myself in the past and again has come caveats is non-commutative spectral geometry. So that is an approach that tries to find the geometrical kind of explanation for the standard model of particle physics, taking what we know at the scales for which the standard model has been tested, and from there going up. So you have what they call the almost commutative spaces, near but below the Planck scale. So you have to take, I'm not going to go into the detail about that. So that's the approach that has been originated by Alain Kohns and his collaborators years back. I had built with a student of mine the cosmological model based on that. But this still is not a quantum theory. So you can test it, you can build the cosmological model out of that. It's the only theory that I know where you try exactly to couple together the gravitational sector and the standard model, so the particles. So at some point, you have to go to the, you know, full non-commutative spaces at the Planck scale. There has been some approach to try to couple it with loop quantum gravity and try to rewrite that in terms of the Azteca writables, but something very difficult and has not been completed. So there is an approach there, but still has not been, has not arrived at the limit that you want in order to have a full quantum gravity theory. But that's the only one that I know and I have been working in the past. So this is my problem. You know, it should somehow. We heard the other day, I think by Renata, that probably if you go at the Planck scale, the matter part is not that important. That's something that for me lets me a bit puzzled, but something to be seen. But, my kind of more conservative approach is that I would like the matter part to emerge from the fundamental theory itself. I don't know if I answered your question, but that's...
You did.
thank you, Mary. Robert?
Yes, so I'd also like to reply to your question because you addressed it to the entire panel. So I just think that inflation has been very useful as a toy model. I think we should just give up on it. There are better things in the market now. It's a toy model. We've learned things. We've seen the failures. Let's move on to something more promising. Some of us have different ideas on what is more promising, but I think, unfortunately, I think that what is holding progress in the theoretical community up is the fact that most people think that inflation has happened. It's even gotten into the astronomy textbooks. I think this is bad. This is holding up progress. We really need new ideas.
Can I add something, Robert? I think that a very positive point is that now the number of people who start questioning the validity of the standard inflation, it increases. So I think that's something that goes to the right direction.
Perfect. Thank you. I see Fernando has his hand up. Go ahead.
Yes, just to change a little bit the subject. Yes, it's a question for Abhay. I think I didn't get the reason, but you seem to have claimed that the loop quantum gravity predicts a contracting period of, or is that a general prediction, or is one of the features that can be avoided?
Yeah. So no, I think these are certain conditions. I mean that one is using. So let me say. In the question is really about, okay, there are many solutions to the quantum-corrected quantum-corrected equations of cosmology coming from loop quantum cosmology. And then, each solution would give you different different predictions, I mean, depending on what it is. So what one is doing is one is really narrowing down the possible states at the bounds. Now, these are states of first of the background geometry itself. Now, in standard inflation, one doesn't do that because one just ignores what happened before what I was calling onset, that is to say the time that the largest wavelength mode exited the Hubble horizon. Now, then one just looks at, and one wants to have the 65 E4s after that and so on. But here the statement is that one doesn't want to do that because it's in the middle of something. One wants to give the position. And then there are very detailed proposal about the choice of these initial conditions. And it really brings together a kind of the quantum geometry of loop quantum cosmology in a very, very strong way. And it has to do with what the state does from the point of a spin network and the quanta of geometry at the bounds itself. So there is certain condition that is coming in. I can, in the break, mm-hmm. I can explain to you in great detail about that. And then similarly, the question is about what conditions should we choose for the perturbations. Now, in standard inflation, one would just put that condition at the saying that is Bunch Davis vacuum because it's quasi-de Sitter at the onset of inflation up here. But of course, it depends on where you put the Bunch Davis vacuum because as soon as that difference is reasonably small, so one just ignores that. So here one has to give this precise some condition, right? And then again, what one chooses is a small set of data by postulating some principle. And that principle has to do with the quantum extension of Penrose's wild curvature hypothesis. So there is a quantum extension of that. One puts it near the bounds. It's rather intricate and rather very detailed. about how to minimize uncertainties. It's basically saying that while curvature cannot be zero, because in quantum theory there's always going to be fluctuations, and one is really controlling those fluctuations by putting those initial conditions. So it really is for this, there's a choice of initial conditions, but small choice of initial conditions for which these predictions are out there. And I just want to say that, you know, in terms of inflation, that my point of view is very similar, namely that inflation is not a fundamental theory. Inflation is really, I mean, this is, people have said it very nicely, it's a framework on which to hang a theory. And so, you know, we just use it, it's like the hydrogen atom. It's not a fundamental theory, but it's wrong. I mean, there are no orbits in a hydrogen atom. But nonetheless, it guided us. And so my point of view is very similar, is that,
take it. Mary, go ahead.
Yeah, I would like to add something about the inflation and all this discussion, which goes a bit along the lines of what you said before, for people to collaborate. So, for instance, a few years back, in the context of a group field cosmology, we say that we have this tetrahedra, this quantum geometry, that you have to glue them together. They have somehow to speak to each other. So you have to put an interaction. And we gave the prescription what kind of interaction you should put in order to have as many as folds as you want. And from what I see, there is further work that has been done on that. So that's a kind of prescription that we give from what we want to explain, that can go back to the people who built the theory itself, who say, can you create this kind of state that we want so that it can give the universe that we want? So this kind, so there are approaches which come from quantum gravity inspired cosmological models that can give some answers to these questions, but you need really the collaboration between the two communities. So there is ongoing work there. And of course, I believe once you are pretty aware and you understand very well the background, then you move to the next stage to discuss about perturbations.
Yeah. So the principles I suggested were influenced by the work that Mary was talking about.
So we are at the last like 10, 15 minutes of this. So I just wanted to kind of add a little bit of a commentary. So especially for the, I mean, I think everybody would recognize this, but especially for the young people in the audience, this is like a menu for what you may want to be spending the next 30, 40 years on. It might be one of them, the right thing that you want to work on. There might be none of them. That's the right thing for you. But it is important to recognize that, there are something that you want to look for to make progress, and that's why I'm coming back to the question of progress, that some problems have been with us for a long time, like the cosmological constant problem, and they are very important, but if we cannot make progress in solving them, then maybe we should pick something that we can make progress on. So I want to ask people, the younger people in the audience, we heard a lot from like old people like me a lot here, but I mean, if you are a student and you want to decide what you want to do, a student or a postdoc, you want to decide what you want to do, I mean, is there anything else that should be on this board? Or is there a question you want to ask someone from more senior people that would help you decide if this is for you or there is something else? Younger people, don't be shy. Anyone?
Just put someone on the spotlight.
I want to put someone in a spot. yeah, okay. Let's see who I should go with. So Therese, tell me. Well, it was Ghazal's idea, so you can blame her.
Oh, you're actually serious.
Can you repeat?
I mean, I haven't formulated something.
You haven't formulated. Okay.
What about on the online? I mean,
actually, is there someone online who want to ask something? Do you? Oh, okay. So let's turn to the online people. Thanks for bringing that up. So do you want to turn on? Should we ask them to unmute, or you want to read the questions?
So maybe I can pick up like one or two questions.
Sorry, we cannot hear well.
Oh, yes. So I will, because there are so many questions. Maybe I can pick up one.
It's hard to see the age of the people who write the questions.
So one of the questions, could we get a summarize of alternatives to inflation?
Can you louder?
Could we get a summary of alternatives to inflation?
What is this? Summary of alternatives to inflation. I don't. Robert is. What are the alternatives to inflation? Because right. I think most people have only heard about inflation, maybe about bouncing scenarios. But yeah, Robert, tell us what are the alternatives to inflation.
So, good. So there are bouncing cosmologies where you assume that there's new physics that gives a bounce from contraction to expansion. There are various versions of that. Then there are emergent scenarios. Then there are many other scenarios which other people have proposed. So, but if you just want two classes, I would say bouncing cosmologies and emergent cosmologies. And among bouncing cosmologies, there are bouncing cosmologies where you have a slow phase of contraction followed by standard Big Bang expansion. Those are called the ekpyrotic scenarios. And those are promising because then the contracting phase is an attractor in initial condition space. So if Paul Steinort were here, he would basically be putting in, making a big plug for such scenarios. But in all scenarios, you have to go beyond effective field theory. So I think that's a common feature of all scenarios, including inflation, if you want inflation.
Okay. Thanks. So there's another question there. Cole, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I had a question. Do you think that we've learned everything that we can from the standard model in the sense that if we have a theory of quantum gravity, shouldn't it also be able to predict things like the mass spectrum of the fundamental particles? Is there still lots to be learned from our understanding of the standard model in terms of quantum gravity? And is that sort of a good place to look as to like maybe why is there three generations of fermions, things like that?
Could you repeat the question?
I actually couldn't hear.
We couldn't hear well. Somehow here.
Okay, can you repeat that question?
Yeah. Basically, I'm just wondering if we've learned everything that we can from the standard model in terms of quantum gravity. Like, I think that if we understood the mass spectrum of the fermions, why these masses, that would require some explanation in terms of quantum gravity.
Right, okay.
Same with, like, why three generations of fermions, these sorts of things. Is there, like, a...
Perfect. I think Neil has an answer to that question.
So I think the answer is yes, and particularly people like Astrid Eichhorn have been pushing this, which I think is very important. Friday, I'm going to explain why there are the three generations, and it does come from quantum gravity, but in a very simplistic approach, I'll explain. But the same approach also requires that the Higgs field is not fundamental. And so, I think thinking about quantum gravity and how gravity couples to the standard model is a very fruitful avenue and has been surprisingly little pursued.
Okay, very good.
Fernando has something to say.
Sorry, what was the question? Sorry.
Fernando.
Go ahead. Oh, Fernando, sorry, I wasn't looking.
No, I have an alternative answer, which is the one that nobody likes here, is the string theory. So, yes, so I can talk about that on Friday also.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's just like follow up on that. So I think that there's one, you know, direct interplay between cosmology and maybe the standard model. Something that I find fascinating is like observed values of neutrino masses is lambda to the 1/4. Okay, you take the vacuum energy associated to the cosmological constant, it's an energy density, take the 4th power of that, and you roughly get neutrino mass scale. And I think that's not a coincidence. There's probably, you know, for instance, we wrote down this model where we tried to explain that by saying that, you know, the same effects that give you the vacuum energy, there's some Cassium energy in some extra dimension, they're also related to neutrino masses. But that's one scenario. There could be other ways to explain this. But I think that's a great question to ask. I mean, there's certainly no reason,
in the standard model or in cosmology, why those two things should agree so closely.
Very good. I think these are all excellent, excellent questions and excellent points. Was there anything else the panel wanted to mention on this topic? So the connection between the standard model and, I mean, at this barely Big Bang cosmology, this is a really underexplored, I would say, direction. So I think we're kind of coming up to the hour. I mean, it's been a long day. We still have a few minutes if there are any questions, but I just wanted to just recap. If there is anything else that needs to be, so I did develop a roadmap. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but I tried to kind of, as much as there was room, put things based on what panelists had said here and based on questions of the audience. Again, the focus I like to think about, although we haven't heard a lot from the younger people in the audience, some of them very bolder than others, this is all for you because people who get old, they get dug in into their positions, have very strong ideas that cannot be convinced otherwise, but they will, that may not matter at some point. It's the younger people who decide what to work on, and they're going to make the new breakthroughs and new discoveries, and then they have to decide if they want to keep pursuing one of these directions or something completely different. So is there something else you want me to put on this board, either from younger or older audience, which you don't see? Okay, Neil?
Something which Robert referred to, and we had a beautiful talk this morning by Pedro on, are the only sensible theories S-matrix theories? Because some people, some very good people, are now arguing that, I think Robert was indicating this too, that that the cosmological constant cannot be constant if you have a S-matrix theory, if the only sensible theories are S-matrix theories. So again, to challenge Abhay, is loop quantum gravity an S-matrix theory?
No, it's not.
So maybe can you comment on this claim that the only sensible theories are S-matrix theories?
I mean, one is not talking about just it's applied to cosmology, where there is no S-matrix. S-matrix theory is something that can be part of loop quantum gravity. In fact, we just started working about this, combining these ideas about, the way that this connection variables were discovered was really looking at scry and the helicity states and such thing, and then went to the space-like surface. So now one is going back and looking at spin networks and such thing, at null infinities, and that would actually then incorporate or make the real bridge between the things about celestial holography that and so on and so forth. So the idea here is that S-matrix theory is a part of loop quantum gravity, but it's only a sector, just like cosmology would be a sector, just like for general relativity, gravitational waves and such thing, asymptotic flatness is a sector, and this other thing is also a sector. So these are various sectors, just like general relativity is, bridge and can be applied to various physical systems. So here we apply to, processes for which S-matrix is useful.
Well, let me try and be more challenging. If somebody shows that there is no S-matrix, which is consistent with loop quantum cosmology, quantum gravity. I mean, if Pedro did some calculation and he showed, given these the assumptions underlying it, there's simply no S-matrix, would you be disappointed or
happy? I mean,
it
depends on what the sense of S-matrix is. In a sense, there is no S-matrix even today for QED because of infrared problems, right? So you have to really formulate it in an algebraic quantum field theory way and so on and so forth, and it's not finished even there. So it depends on what the sense would be in which there is no S-matrix, right? But certainly there will be some sense in which, very robust sense in which if one shows there is no S-matrix in this robust sense, then yeah, because it should be able to describe the elementary particle processes and so on and so forth. Then, if it is there is no S-matrix in a robust sense, then I would say it's wrong. Yeah.
So I'm sorry. I need to sorry to cut you off. There are three people I want to hear from before we, and me. Okay, so maybe a little bit later. So Francesca, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I wanted to follow up on this because, of course, asking to a theory to be consistent to something that is not proved is a bit stupid. So on the other hand, we know very well that there is a cosmological constant that is positive out there, and this is one of the most beautiful results of loop quantum gravity. I hope, Neil, you can learn more about this.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Francesca. Before, did you want to have another point or...?
Yes, I wanted to follow up on what Neil said about the cosmological concept that he seems to be discussing with Fernando. So,
maybe before that, but before he's done, Yasaman, you haven't said anything since your remarks. Did you want to add any points, maybe to the board or to the things that came up? Why do you think there will be a new predictions? You said new predictions. I like that very much. I even circled that. What new prediction? Can you think of a new prediction that quantum gravity will give us?
If we knew it, there was not new.
Well, that, it's going to be new as of now. And then it will be old. But
if it was new, I'm not going to share it.
Give us your new prediction. Of course, it won't be new after you say it. But
well, I mean, I guess, so I haven't mentioned anything about ever-present lambda from causal set theory. And I'm sure a lot of you don't know about this model. It's a model of a fluctuating cosmological constant from causal set theory. And remarkably, the model dates back to 1987 in its first heuristic rendition. It was and still is in a very incomplete form, but it very simply uses core properties of causal set theory. And as I mentioned, the idea was first introduced in 1987. And it's an argument that predicts a value for the cosmological constant that is consistent with what we observe today. So in some sense, that was a prediction back then. And more recent, it's sporadically people have worked on this model since then. And more recently, there has been a new wave of research done on this model. It's a very rich model. And it has a lot of potential to bring with it new predictions. So one of the main features it has is that it is also very, very likely for the sign of the cosmological constant to have been different at some point in the history of our universe. So that is also a, I suppose, prediction of this model. So if there were some evidence in either current or future data that would lend support to that, so that would be very nice for this model. And I think there are a lot of like other potential predictions, but it's a bit premature for me to maybe put them out there.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And we're out of time. You're the organizer, so you get to ask the question or do whatever you want.
I really would like to ask a question, but okay, just a very quick follow-up to what Neil said. I think it is sometimes confusing to talk about constant or non-constant cosmological constants, so the one in the action, because, I mean, we don't measure Lagrangians, of course. And what we measure, at least to my understanding, instead is omega lambda. But to omega lambda, it can contribute the cosmological constant, but also other quantities can contribute. So for instance, if one has a scalar field in the theory, that would also enter omega lambda, that is what we measure. So in this sense, yes, omega lambda will vary, but whether lambda, the lambda of the Lagrangian varies, is probably ill-posed question. And from a quantum field theory point of view, lambda in the Lagrangian cannot vary because it's just a volume term.
Okay, thank you very much, Alessia. And I think that concludes our panel discussion.